There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, and there you have it.
There you go.
With the qualifying.
Welcome to AffleMeekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Steve Faub, my co-host. This is podcast number 1105, July 28th, 2025, Stephen.
This F1 Weekly Podcast is brought to you by Yahoo Ads. Yahoo Ads get you the F1Weekly.com web server for the ads that interest you. From cars to car parts, Yahoo Ads gets you everything that you could possibly want. Click on them, you know you want to.
Thank you, Steve, and thank you, Yahoo Ads. Piastri passes Norris on lap one and never looked back. This has got to be the most uneventful wet race I've ever seen. Dismal. I mean, dismal weekend for Aston Martin. Max, not happy with the rain delay. His philosophy is, if you can't see, lift. And this week's Nasser Hamid Corner, we have Peter Windsor, Colton Herta, and Logan Sargeant. Very, 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 very interesting. And yes, we do need your contributions to keep this program on the air. Just click on the Support F1 Weekly tab. You know, you'll want to. Well, there you have it. A wet Spa Grand Prix. That was really quite, well, once Oscar passed Norris, it was bye-bye birdie. But let's talk about qualifying real quickly. I mean, Aston Martin, what is... I mean, they take a step forward and take 14 steps backwards. I mean, dismal out in Q1. It was terrible to watch. And Lewis Hamilton out in Q1 was quite shocking. Now, we could talk about the sprint race, which was not super exciting. But once Max got the pass, dry, sunny day. It was done. He had that low downforce swing. And they had no chance, and he was able to keep them at bay. Max wins, blah, blah, blah. But it was. Now, let's talk about qualifying real quickly. Lewis Hamilton out in Q1, where Leclerc makes it all the way to Q3. P4. So I don't know what's going on there, but I think Hamilton had a bigger setup for rain. I'm not sure, but that's all they talked about was rain. And Max was on the Hamilton page. He was completely set up for rain as well. So I was very disappointed with the race start. Really, that rolling start was terrible. I mean, I do watch IndyCar every once in a while. They do a rolling start, and they go side by side, sort of displaying the grid right before the green flag is waved. And there was none of that. I mean, it was just single line. Norris was ahead and didn't get a great start. But I just really didn't like that rolling start, especially since we really didn't have a huge storm on our hands here. I think a standing start is part of being at Spa. It's part of being racing in the wet. And I think we're slowly, slowly, slowly drifting away from wet races. I mean, Spa is what everybody's expecting. Max is expecting it. He's old school. Lewis is old school. And I think we did get robbed because it was really a dry race. But on the other hand, Albon scores points. Tsunoda. Seventh in qualifying, he falls out of the points very strangely. I think he had a little bit of bad luck on his pit stop. But Antonelli really having a terrible weekend as well. They're talking about his confidence being marred, and Russell continues. He continues, and he is overwhelmed by this Verstappen rumor of Verstappen going to Mercedes. It's not going to happen, folks. I think Wolf is right. Stick with Antonelli because he's going to be a lot of work, and Russell is a good go-to, steady as you go, consistent every weekend. But even George is complaining about the Mercedes taking a few steps back. But nobody took as many steps back as Aston Martin. I mean, I don't know. I expect good things in these old school tracks, and Aston had nothing. And, well, we'll see what happens. Let's hope 2026 brings them a lot of good luck. Because if not, Fernando, you could have retired years ago and saved us all this misery. But anyway, yeah, congratulations to McLaren. I mean, hey, they've got this championship in the bag. It's very impressive. And look on how Oscar is not only capitalizing on every Norris mistake, but he's really becoming the dominant factor. Very good in the wet, of what wet we had. And you could tell, I think he's the powerhouse. I think he's the big one. The mental strength, I think, is in Oscar's corner. So he's definitely going to win the Drivers' Championship unless something very bizarre happens. On the other hand, I don't know. What is going to happen with the 2026 cars? It sounds like it's going to be scary the way the drivers are talking. I think it's going to be exciting, and all this is going to just going to fade away like they do every time there's a big change. But we'll see. Leclerc not too happy with them. Max has not spoken about them too much because he has an open mind. And as long as it has four wheels, he's ready to go. And of course, Max winning the sprint race was great for their new principal. As we know, Christian Horner is gone. And I thought Mekies did a fantastic job. He's very good at what he does. And he's done practically everything a team principal can do. He did such a good job at racing bulls that I'm very, very happy for Mekies. And there you have it. Max is definitely out of this championship. This is going to be all papaya orange. I will have to have a lot of Stellas to get over this one. I'm not a McLaren fan. I will continue to survive. Anyway, we have a very cool Nasser Hemi corner this week. We have Peter Windsor. Peter Windsor, very, very uplifting. Always a good interview. We have Colton Herta in England, I believe. And we have a young Logan Sargeant who lives in Switzerland. And he explains all that in the interview. So, good stuff from Nasser, as always. We'll see what happens in Hungary, but Piastri is going to start dominating this season, and he's going to end in a dominating fashion. I think Norris is already content to be the nice guy. But they've only crashed into each other a few times, so you have to give it to McLaren. They've admitted, Zak Brown has said, that these guys will crash again in the future. But I don't see that happening. I think it's going to be all well-behaved and civilized. And Max is just going to get more bored every day. But there you have it. So, don't forget, enjoy NAS. And NAS, I think about you every day. Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, as we spin the globe and go around the world with Motorsports Mondial and the king, the Swami himself, Nasser Hamid. Peter Windsor has now spoken. Nasser?
Yes, sir. First of all, my thanks to Peter Windsor and also our mutual friend and fellow listener. Mr. Phil Pegler, who made this meeting possible. It was great honor, privilege, and fascinating stories from Peter Windsor, obviously one of the great motor racing journalists of our time. I've enjoyed his work for many, many years. Has been team manager at Ferrari, and Williams was team manager to Carlos Reutemann, whom we interviewed a few years ago. So it was a very fascinating conversation. I thank him very much for his time, and hopefully we can chat more about motor racing, sport we all love so much, down the road.
Okay, folks, I'm here with Peter Windsor, one of the great F1 journalists, a gentleman whose work I've enjoyed for many, many years. Peter, great to have you. Welcome to F1 Weekly. How are you today?
I'm very well, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on board.
I must say I have enjoyed your work for a long time. Before we get to Q&A, please give your thoughts on the great season we are having this year.
Well, yeah, we are having a great season. I think most seasons are great. I love Formula One, and I actually find it quite difficult in my mind to say this season is better than that season. And I think it depends, of course, on the individual thing, what you enjoy about our sport, and you know, maybe how many overtaking maneuvers there are, how many different winners there are. In my case, enjoyment is really seeing good drivers in good cars doing what they do well, and that's what I love. And it's been interesting watching Lewis Hamilton dealing with a car that he hasn't been particularly comfortable with, and watching how he's adapted and grown. Likewise with Nico, and I love watching Kimi drive as well, so that's been a lot of fun.
Do you love his radio communication?
I don't listen to it that much, to be honest. I usually have the volume turned down. I listen to the... I'm a bit isolated in what I do, but I tend to love watching the onboard just with the engine note and focusing on that and listening to the throttle, the way they're using the throttle and when they're coming out of the power. You don't get any of the graphics, you don't get any of the shouting and screaming, and you get a real feel for what it's like being on board the car. So we're lucky to be in a position to see that and to choose with whom we can be on board during the race, and that's how I watch most of the Grand Prix.
Okay, great. Your motor racing life started at the age of 13 as a flag marshal in Australia. Please tell us, what was the spark for your interest in racing and about those early days?
Well, I grew up in Australia, as you rightly say. My dad was, bless him, wonderful father. I couldn't have had a better dad. And he, although we lived in Australia, we played several trips back to England every 4 years, in fact, as a family. And I remember in 1962, when I was 10, my family, I have to say, were absolutely mad, still are, on horse racing, by which I mean steeplechasing in England, jumps on grass, a very specific type of horse racing. And we were going to some of that in England on Easter Monday. And I remember we were in my cousin's little Morris Minor, and he had a little transistor radio in a leather case and an aerial on the roof. Nothing was very... We couldn't hear. It was crackly. And it was the day Stirling Moss had his accident at Goodwood. And I remember, in between the horse racing commentary, they kept jumping, I think, to Robin Richards on the radio, saying there's just been a big accident at Goodwood. The great British driver Stirling Moss has been seriously injured. We'll give you more information when we have it. Meanwhile, Graham Hill is the leader of the race. And I remember at the time thinking, wow, that's really interesting. What a terrible thing this poor man's had this accident. But what a feeling of excitement there was there. And I obviously did some research at that point and persuaded one of my godmothers to buy me a Scalextric set. And I started looking at all the diagrams and which car I could be on and choose. And then not long after that, Jim Clark published his autobiography, 64 indeed, and that really captured me. I read that from front cover to cover. It's the first book I ever read, ever bought, and I can still memorize most of the prose in that book. And Jim Clark became my new focus in life, really, at the age of, 12?
Very interesting you mentioned Robin Richards. My interest in motor racing, what really made the difference in 1973, BBC had a program called, I think, Sports Call on Saturdays, BBC World Service, and I'll never forget at 7 o'clock when it would start, the guy said, we'll go to Le Mans for the start of the race with Robin Richards, and I still remember him saying, Matra, Ferrari, Matra. Very interesting. Okay, Tasman was a great series. Did you ever meet Timmy Mayer, brother of Teddy Mayer?
Sadly not. 1964, the year he raced at Warwick Farm, my circuit, and I only went to this Warwick Farm until I was a bit old enough to travel. Tim was Bruce's teammate, obviously. That was the first appearance of Bruce McLaren Motor Racing Limited. I saw him drive, that's all I can say, and I saw him from about as far away as I am from you now. But I was too young to be able to say, hello, I'm Peter Windsor, I'm pleased to meet you. But I was in awe of Tim. I knew what he'd done in America. I knew what he'd done in Formula Junior, even in Mini Coopers in England for a little bit. And Tyler Alexander came over with him. I remember seeing Tyler there. And obviously, I was a big Bruce McLaren fan, as well as I've just said I was a Clark fan, but if I had to nominate my second driver, it would have been Bruce McLaren. And I loved the way his helmet was, the way he smiled, the way he looked in the car. I loved the Coopers at that point. And it all captured my imagination. And I was absolutely heartbroken when I heard the news. I can still remember the exact phraseology they used. It was a Saturday afternoon. I was in my house in Australia, and there was no television of the Tasman races at all away from Sydney. And I knew they were in Longford, Tasmania, and I remember getting the news report of it was after they'd said who was qualified first, etc. And they said and practice was marred by an accident involving the young American driver Tim Mayer, whose car became airborne on the approach to the Longford pub, hit the trees, and Tim later succumbed to his injuries, is the phrase they used. And I remember asking my dad, what does that mean, succumb to his injuries? And then I was completely heartbroken. And I think that was probably one of the first times I'd kind of come face to face with the mortality of drivers and what motor racing really meant to many of them.
That's what Sever's accident did that to me in 73. Okay, my favorite story from your days in Australia is talking about Jim Clark mowing the lawn of the Gagan family. Let's hear what led to this, please.
Well, that was a story that I heard through Leo Gagan, who was a wonderful, still is a wonderful guy. He was a great driver, very consistent. And the Gagan family were an institution in Australian motorsport from the very early 60s, and they were the Lotus dealers for New South Wales, so they had all the latest Lotus stuff, and their basic colours were black, and they were just immaculate. And Jim was very close to Leo and his brother Ian, who raced, and Tom, the father, who was running the whole show for a while before he passed away. And the Lotus in 66, the Lotus 39 Tasman car was, and 65, was garaged at the Gagans up the road from Warwick Farm at Liverpool. All very convenient. The circuit and the Gagan headquarters are very near one another. And one day Jim turned up at the house to meet Leo, and they were going to have a barbecue or whatever, and Leo was late, not there, and his mum was there, and she was expecting a gardener to mow the lawns. And when Jim turned up, she said, and this is Leo telling me this, she said, oh, I'm glad you're here, you're a bit late, anyway, the mower's over there. So Jimmy, A, think he was quite funny, and B, probably because he quite enjoyed mowing lawns, I know quite a lot of people that do, got on with it and started mowing the lawn, and Leo arrived to find Jimmy Clark mowing his lawn.
Fantastic story.
Yeah.
It was around this time you met Peter Collins, and later you hooked up with him in England. What was your first job, and what was the goal when you came back to the UK?
Well, I met Peter because in my school holidays, I got a job with the local club that ran the motor racing at Warwick Farm. And that was not ordinary motor racing, nor was it an ordinary circuit. We're talking one of the best racing circuits in the world, Warwick Farm. It no longer exists. And the AARC, Australian Automobile Racing Club, one of the best run organizational clubs ever in the history of motorsport, I would say, without any doubt at all. Jeff Sykes was the man behind it. He started life at the BARC and was sent out to Australia to design Warwick Farm and then create the organizational structure. So I worked for Jeff and his very small team of people in my school holidays, stamping letters, sealing envelopes, cleaning cars, getting the lunch for them, just to be a part of the motor racing world. I didn't get paid, obviously, but I got a lunch every day, and I got up every morning at 6 o'clock. I was always there at the office. I loved it, cleaning the windows, just to be a part of the motor racing world. And I met Peter Collins there because and that was another reason to be there, because the AARC offices had a subscription to Motoring News and Autosport, and it was my first chance to read motor racing news as it happened within sort of 2 or 3 weeks of it happening. So that was a wonderful thing. And Peter used to come in and read the magazines as well, and we started chatting. So we got to know one another very well. And he was a couple of years older than I, and he was karting quite early on. So I started getting into that with Peter. And but later on, I went to England and started writing as a journalist. And in answer to your question, there was a moment when Andrew Ferguson said to me, I can remember it was at Thruxton, that Lotus were looking for an assistant team manager because he, Andrew, was no longer going to fly. He just had a complete phobia about flying, and they needed a guy who was capable of being Andrew's assistant but going to races. And I remember thinking at the time, oh, I'd love to do that myself, and then thinking, oh no, I wouldn't be good enough to do that, but Peter would be great for that. And so Peter was just getting married in Sydney, and I sent him a telegram, not an email, telegram in the days of telegrams, and I said, congratulations to you, I hope everything's gone well. By the way, I think I can get you an interview at Lotus for a job as assistant team manager, but you need to get over here within a week. And he did, and he came over, and I'm sure Jane, his wife, didn't appreciate it, but Peter then stayed with me for 3 or 4 months while all those negotiations went on. He got a part-time job at Ralt, and then he got in as the assistant team manager. And because I had Peter in there, when I met Nigel Mansell for the first time and started to really believe in Nigel, I used my connection with Peter to get Nigel a test with Peter's help in the F1 car, and then get him the contract with Lotus, and then everything went from there. So one thing led to another, and if I hadn't got Peter in at Lotus, I doubt I would have been able to help Nigel get in at Lotus, and Nigel probably would never have gone into Formula One.
Now, Nigel is in the next question. How important was the support of Pace Petroleum in getting Arnage to the big league? And I guess you were the main man behind the sponsorship?
Well, yeah, I mean, when I met Nigel, I was riding for Autocar, and actually I met him through a wonderful guy who was Trevor Taylor's manager, and he and I became friends because I wanted to meet Trevor, who was Jim Clark's teammate, and find out lots of Jim Clark stories from Trevor. And indeed, I was a huge Trevor Taylor fan as well. So he rang me one day and said, I've just met an English driver who's as good as anybody I've seen since Jimmy. You've got to see him drive. And so I did. I went over, and Nigel was in Formula Ford at that point. And yeah, he was really good. But then I went up to Birmingham to meet him, where he mortgaged his house. He was just on the point of mortgaging his house to finance 5 races in a March Formula 3 car. And I went to see him first time out in the March, out the back at Thruxton. And I remember at that moment, I'd already been on the road quite a long time with Carlos Reutemann, so I started to get a pretty good feel. Something I think I'd always had anyway, for being able to watch the way drivers do work in cars and how they use their hands and their feet. And Nigel, to my eye, was absolutely right there. He was another Carlos Reutemann, the way he drove. Very fingertippy, very good at getting the car early into the corner, never loaded up the front too much, very good at coming out of the brake pedal pressure at the right rate to get the front to work, and just very, very economical in the way he was driving. And I became a believer in Nigel. And on top of that, the fact that he had lots of other things. He was a crack clay pigeon shot like Jackie Stewart. He was a single-figure handicapped golfer. He was very good at judo at that point, and karate, and lots of things going for him. I started writing letters, and I used to get to my office 2 hours earlier than I needed to, and I'd spend those 2 hours from 6 until 8 at Autocar composing and writing letters to potential sponsors for Nigel. I bought the Times 1000 book of companies and just went through them one by one, wrote to them all, usually to the CEO. I was reading lots of books on how to raise sponsorship at that point, and I used to then follow up. And I remember ringing Victor Gauntlet one day of Pace, and I just rang him and I said, because I'd read somewhere that you should ring very early in the morning, you might get the CEO at his desk early in the morning before the secretary comes in. And there was some article I'd read in the New York Times, I think, and Victor Gauntlet picked up the phone, and I said, I'm Peter Windsor, I wrote to you. He said, oh yes, I remember, you're the chap that wants me to make a bet on a young driver, a bit like betting on a horse. I said, well, it's not really that, it's just that if he if he doesn't make Formula One, you won't get your money back. But if he does, and there's a conflict of sponsors between your company and the F1 team, you will get your money back. And he said, oh, this sounds interesting. Come and have lunch. So I had lunch. And yeah, we did. We found the money that was to keep him racing in Formula 3 in 1980, whereas his first five races were in 78. So yeah, I think it helped a lot. He was doing Formula 3 while he was, I'd also helped him get the Ralph F2 Honda test drive with Ron Toranak. He did a couple of races. And at that point, we'd got him in, Peter and I'd got him in at Lotus as a test driver there as well, or test contract, and he did a bit of testing as well. So yeah, it was a good thing.
One guy who did not believe in Nigel Mansell was Peter Waugh, that he would give Nige the good and bad news at the Brazilian Grand Prix. Good news, I have two passes. Bad news, none for you. And you were there. What was wrong there? These people could not work together.
Well, I think there were two things with Nigel. One was, if you didn't actually watch him drive and you just based your assessment, as most people do in motor racing, I think, on how the guy is in the paddock area, what his handshake's like, what he talks about, and indeed his results, it was very easy, if you wanted to, in all that period, to paint a pretty black picture of Nigel Mansell. He was not an easy guy, never has been, never will be. He's the sort of guy born to be the commander of a ship, and if you want to be on his ship and play by his rules and take his orders, fine, but if you don't even bother. And of course, he'd never been in quick cars. I mean, if we assume now Nigel is a great Grand Prix driver in the history of the sport, of all the drivers who take that title, a great Grand Prix driver, he is the one driver that stands out as never having competitive cars until about 1980, back end of 85. So he spent a lot of his career in underfinanced, poor machinery, and so he never really looked very good. But if you look between the lines, he was always good. Monaco 1980, Formula 3 race, the March 803 was diabolical. If you couldn't drive in that race unless you're in a March 793, which was a much better car, and as soon as you touched the curb, the top rocker arm bent in half. That's how bad the March 803 was. Nigel was the only 803 driver to qualify for the final. Nobody noticed it, and he finished second last, I think. But that was an epic drive. That was Nigel's drive that we saw at Monaco in 92 or 87 when he should have won was the drive he did in 1980, but nobody saw it. And I think Peter Waugh, sadly, was only looking at the results and the handshake, and I don't remember Peter ever being out on the circuit watching Nigel. And I think the other thing is that there was basically a groundswell of opinion in the press at the time, the autosport particularly, not necessarily motor news, but more autosport, they were not very pro-Nigel either. He wasn't an easy guy to interview. He wasn't an easy guy to talk to. Derek Warwick, Kenny Acheson, Stefan Johansson, they were the cool guys. Nigel was always an effort. And I do remember, and I think you're probably going to see it there, that 1980 Austrian Grand Prix, when we'd got Nigel a chance in the third works Lotus, that autosport actually said, we can't believe Lotus have signed Mansell. There are many more British drivers deserving of this opportunity. And that was autosport 1980. This is the same autosport that then had something like six front covers in a row with Nigel Mansell on it in 1992. You know, need I say more?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, you try to do a deal. How are we doing on time?
10 minutes.
Okay, you try to do a deal with Shark, Greg Norman, to buy the Brabham team in 1989. Can you please tell us how you convinced him on this deal and what were the main reasons for this deal ending up in a court of law?
Well, Greg was never part of the purchase of the team, and it was, I was in business with Walter Brunn, who had won the World Sports Car Championship the year before, Swiss Porsche entrant, part-time driver. He had a fledgling F1 team called Eurobrunn at that point, Eurobrunn, and he wanted to do a lot more than that. And I was at Williams at the time, and he and I got together. He approached me and said, you know, I'd love you to come in and run this operation. It's going to be my team, but you can have a small percentage of it, but I'd like you to run it and put together. And I was quite enthusiastic about that. He said, you know, we're going to run Stefano Modena in one car. He's my driver, but we got enough. I will underwrite the budget for 2 years, and we got enough to sign another driver up to X amount. We need to decide what engines we're going to use, etc., etc. And one of the things I'd always thought, and still think today, actually, is that there's quite a lot of synergy between golf and motorsport, partly because of the timing and the hand-eye coordination you need for golf and the patience. And I think a lot of that applies to driving a racing car. But I think there's also another little thing about golf, which is that on the pro-am days, the pro golfers tend to play rounds with CEO, Fortune 500 people. And if you were into Formula One and you've got a stake in a Formula One team, it's a great time to be talking to new potential sponsors for a Formula One team. Much better opportunity than racing people ever get. And I'd put Nigel and Greg together because I was very keen on golf, still am, and Nigel was, and I had an opportunity to, before the South Australian Open one year when we were at the Australian Grand Prix, at Williams, I got Nigel an entry in the Pro-Am there, and I knew Greg was playing, so I asked the organizer to put Nigel with Greg, so I put him together and knew that it would be a marriage made in heaven, and it was. And through that, obviously, I met Greg, and I told Greg what we were doing, and I said, Greg, you know, it is the Brabham team that Brun is going to buy, and it's an Australian team. If you'd love to be associated with any way, we would love to do it. You know, and what I'm thinking is exactly what I just said. You know, you're going to be playing with some serious people, and you know, if you've got an interest in an F1 team, not a financial interest, but just an interest, it'd be a great thing for you to play around with and have some fun with. And he said, yeah, what a great idea. I'd love to do that. But it didn't get very far because Brun disappeared from the scene. It wasn't his money that he was spending. It was somebody else's who was then arrested for embezzlement. And I was caught in the middle because by then, obviously, I'd given up my job at Williams. And I had all these people saying I had no stake in the team, which this new guy who subsequently got arrested was supposedly owning and running. So I got thrown to the wolves and left with nothing. So I had to take everybody to court. And I never got to trial, but I got 7 injunctions, all of which went my way. And eventually, of course, I engineered a settlement, and that all got sorted. But it was a pretty tough 2 years. But I learned a lot about Formula One people and legal matters, shall we say.
You were also involved in the USF on a program. Can you tell us what went wrong there or anything you want to say on this?
Well, I'd love to, because it's a similar story to the Brabham thing. If I can look myself in the mirror and feel that I gave it 100% and my intentions were right, and I think it would have been very good. I really think we had a great plan there, but so many things happened that I'd never predicted. I suppose you could argue, I should have predicted them, but they fell outside the normal things you predict and worry about, which are in no particular order. Are we going to have enough money? Will we have the right drivers? Will the car be any good? All the things you normally worry about. All the things that happened were nothing to do with that. But the FIA have said, we don't want you to talk about that. There's a lot of stuff there that would not be good if it came out. So I still abide by what the FIA have instructed.
Well, I appreciate your feedback. Okay, now we come to your all-time favorite front cover, the July 1968 issue of Motor Racing and Sports Car magazine. Excellent snapshot by you. Please explain the man and his ladies and the occasion.
Well, I actually bought a copy of that full magazine off eBay the other day because I had the front cover, but I hadn't got the magazine, but I got the whole thing now. But yeah, I was a big Piers Courage fan. I was a fan of many drivers, but Piers came out to the Tasman Series in 68. I was very impressed. I knew about him then. I knew he was a quick F2, F3 driver, but to see him drive that little McLaren M4A and finish third at Warwick Farm behind Jimmy and Graham, just superb. And then, of course, he won at Longford. And so I became a big Piers Courage fan. And then this magazine, Motor Racing, was a wonderful magazine in the 60s. It was a fairly straightforward front cover for a long time, just a yellow strip with Motor Racing on it and a nice picture. And I've actually got one from 65 when Jimmy's on the front cover in the Indy car, and I got that signed by Jimmy at Warwick Farm, that front cover, so I've still got that. But then Motor Racing went upbeat, and they had these really jazzy front covers, and I couldn't believe that they were as creative and artistic as they were. And when they got this shot of Piers with his wife on one side and some dolly bird on the other, and then the little caption line, "It takes courage to do this," I thought that was just a great front cover. Everything about it I loved. The fact that it was Piers, it was just one cover line. It wasn't plastered with lots of, you know, inside this. It was just that one picture that said it all. And they got Piers to pose for that picture, and Sally, his wife, was in there too. I just thought, what a wonderful thing.
Exactly. Okay, now, like I said, I've enjoyed your work for many, many years. So here is my favorite question to you. If Peter Windsor was turning 22 or 21 in 2014 and making his F1 debut in Albert Park for Ferrari, what will be his choice, Hitco, Brembo, or Carbon Industries?
Very good question. I think it would be Hitco, actually. Only because I think to run Carbon Industries, you've got to have the brake pedal sensitivity of Lewis Hamilton. And I think to run the Brembos, you've got to be thinking, I want to jam these brakes on as hard as I can and not have any problem. In other words, you've got to have a lot of margin. I think the Hitco is a nice compromise between the two. But more than that, I love their Art Deco 60s, 50s, 40s, 30s building in L.A. I love that whole part of American aerospace near LAX that grew up after the Second World War, all those companies, Metalor, and Hitco's one of those, really, in terms of where it blossomed. And it's just a great feel to it. And I also like the kind of cool aspect that it's an American company. Not many people in Formula One know about them or care about them. And there they are, providing brakes to Kimi Raikkonen and Romain Grosjean, doing a good job. So, yeah, I think it would be Hitco. Thanks for asking the question.
Great. Finally, how about a message to our listeners? We have listeners all over the world, Australia, UK, everywhere. I'm sure they would love to hear from you.
Well, it's very sweet of you to say that. I'm sure there are many more people they would love to hear from before me. But all I can say is that I love the past, I love the present, I love the future, and I don't think anybody should be pigeonholed. And I think this webcast does a very good job of embracing all parts of every part of motor racing, as indeed I try to do on my blog and on my show. And I just hope that we never forget the heroes of the past, because without them, we wouldn't be where we are today. Equally, I don't think we should ever take our eye off the ball and look at the next heroes who are coming along in the future. And we're talking here somewhere near the GP3 paddock, in the away from the Formula One circuit, but we've been watching GP3 from afar. And to me, watching those young guys is part of still the excitement of what I love about motor racing. But most of all, thank you for putting this together and for being as enthusiastic and as passionate as you are. It's wonderful to meet people like you.
Thank you so much.
Peter, thanks for joining F1Weekly.com.
Hi, I'm Enzo Fittipaldi, and you guys are listening to F1 Weekly.
Anyway, let's get to this interview, Nasser.
Okay, sir. This interview is with Colton Herta. He is son of Brian Herta, IndyCar racer, race winner, and also a team owner now. And Colton has been racing in karts, and I've been following his career for a few years. Very, very quick. And this is his first year of motor racing in they were going to call this British Formula 4, but there's already a Formula 4 promoted in England by Jonathan Palmer. So they're calling it the MSA Formula. MSA is the Motorsports Authority, sort of like a USAC here in the U.S. So this is the MSA Formula he's racing in. And our meeting took place at Donington, which is a mighty fine track. And my thanks to Colton for talking to us. And we know we'll keep an eye on this young kid as he moves up.
Okay, folks, I'm here at Donington with a young man from California, Colton Herta. Colton, good to meet you. How are you today, sir?
I'm good. It's nice to meet you as well.
Yeah, same here. Now, first thing I want to ask you is, if your dad was a tennis player or some other sports, would you still be following motor racing?
No, I don't think I'd be in the position I am without my dad being in motorsport.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Okay. Now, some years ago, you raced in Vegas, and you were doing very good. I was at that race. Tell us a little bit about your karting career in the U.S., please.
Karting basically made me what I am today. So I started in karting when I was 5 years old, and slowly went up from club racing to national racing and a little bit of international racing, and just been a slow slope upwards, and yeah, decided to keep on climbing up.
Now, when you did some karting in outside the United States, I'm assuming mostly in Europe, what was your first impression of competition here as compared to in the U.S.?
I think it's the same. It really doesn't matter where you go. You're always going to have a fast guy up against you. And I think there's just more professionalism over here, and it's more fast people. They definitely have more money over here in Europe into motorsport because it's more popular than in America. And I think that helps, and it brings a lot more talent in. And, yeah, so it's just more professionalism, more talent, and basically more people.
Now, you did, I believe, Formula Pacific F1600, and you were extremely successful there. Tell us a little bit about that series and what tracks you raced at.
Yeah, it was mostly California, West Coast-based tracks, and we had a stellar year. We won, I think, 10 races out of the 15 races. We had a great year. And, yeah, they basically started my Formula car career, and it was, it wasn't really well-known tracks. We raced at Buttonwillow, Las Vegas, just mainly club tracks, but it was a good competition, and ended to be a really good year.
Were you surprised the level of success you had in Formula 1600 there?
I knew that I had the talent, but I just didn't know how fast it was going to come, and it came quite fast. My dad helped, the team helped a lot, and they really excelled my my career.
Now, you've come here to Europe. Obviously, your goal has to be Formula One. Tell us, obviously, you're 15 years old, so you can get into this series. Tell us what teams you tested with and what made you decide to go with the team you're in, which is obviously a top-notch team.
Yeah, they've just went to Carlin, tested only at Carlin, and I knew it was the one for me. They're very professional, great team, have great background, have a lot of success, and just really good team, so decided to go with them.
Okay, this is your first full season of motor racing. What are your goals, and where would you like to be? Obviously, you want to win, but what would you be consider as, you know, a decent season for you?
Top three in the championship. I want to win the championship, and that's the main goal. Makes it easier to find sponsorship, to get on junior programs for next year as well. And shooting for the championship.
Okay. This series has three races per round. Round one was at Brands Hatch. What was your impression of that track, by the way?
It's a great track. We unfortunately had to do the short version. We go back to the last race to do the long version, but great atmosphere, great facilities, and it's overall just great built track.
Now, I watched the timings in pre-season testing. You were pretty quick. Tell us about the first three races, please, how they went for you.
Unfortunately, we kind of got screwed in the first couple of races. We didn't qualify too well. We've been top five in all pre-season testing. We haven't qualified too well, and it's really hard to pass at Brands. So kind of didn't do well there. And then came here, and we didn't qualify well again, having some issues with the car. And I'm sure we'll figure it out for the race, and we'll go really good.
And if I may ask, during the racing season, where are you based?
I am based in the UK, in Woking, which is, I believe, southwest London.
Woking is not too far from where Ron Dennis sits.
Yeah, no, it's actually about like a 10-minute drive. So, it's get a nice view of McLaren when I'm going to the shop.
Are you missing hot dogs and cheeseburgers here?
No, I'm not allowed to eat that, so I don't miss them. I never...
Now, I know your dad has a racing team, was very successful in racing himself. How much do you depend on him on guidance?
He's my guider. He tells me what to do, what I can do better, what I should be doing, and really taking that information. And it helps me to be a better race car driver for sure, and just want to thank him for that.
And, in Europe, we have quite a few series. How would you like to see your career progress towards Formula One? What series do you have in mind after this and after that?
The main image would be to go from this into Euro F3, and then I haven't really thought about after that. Maybe GP3 or GP2, depending on what series. And I know that they might have the F2 series come out, and that might be a good choice as well. So it really, we have to wait and see. But main goal would be F3 after this, I believe.
Now, in this series, most of the drivers are in your age group. Who do you see as your main competition for the championship?
Teammates, yeah. I have to beat the teammates, and I know they're really good, so it's going to be a challenge. I also see there's a couple good teams, Arden, Fortec. They all have good drivers that are going to contend for the championship.
Now, Formula One, which is your goal, how do you see the season developing? Right now it's going pretty much, once again, Mercedes' way.
Yeah, but hey, they're not going to win forever. We saw that in Red Bull as well. And so it's just going to be keeping on going like this. And I hope that we get a couple equal cars in the next couple of years, and it'll be some good racing. Yeah.
Now, now that you're racing here in Europe, do you have some program where your feats and accomplishments are also made broadcast in the U.S.?
No, I don't.
Well, stay in touch with F1 Weekly, okay?
Yes, I will.
Okay. Finally, how about a message for listeners? You know, we have a lot of listeners in the U.S. and also overseas. And tell them about your website also, please.
I'm just having a good time over here. Just want to thank everyone for supporting me. And thank the U.S. for just being American, pretty much.
Yeah.
I think it's a great country. So, awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Colton, thanks for joining.
F1Weekly.com.
Finally, before we do the Tech Talk by Tim, some bueno music from Viva España. This is Sigona Weizen, Gypsy Ways from Señor Sarasate, performed by the James Last Orchestra of Germania. Please enjoy and wait for Tech Talk by Tim.
This is Tech Talk, and I am excited that winter testing has started and we are well on our way to another season of Formula One. By now, you're probably well aware that the engines have undergone a massive restructuring, and gone are the days of high-revving, naturally aspirated V8s. Here to stay are smaller, lower-revving power units. But if you listen carefully to testing footage, you will hear a distinctive high-pitched whistle, almost like a vacuum. And the device producing that noise, of course, is a turbocharger. The concept of a turbocharger is extremely simple, and it takes less time to explain than to spell. Energy from exhaust gas is used to pump air into the engine. Like many great mechanical and thermal innovations, devices forcing air into engines were developed beginning in the late 1800s, and the turbocharger was patented in 1905. Turbochargers look like donuts or snails and can be pretty small. They have essentially three parts. A turbine housing receives hot gas from the exhaust and uses the gas to turn a shaft. Now, the same concept is used in reverse to extract energy from the rotating shaft to compress fresh air in the compressor housing. This high-pressure air is delivered into the engine for increased power. The basic chemical reaction inside an engine, be it a race car, your own car, or a jet aircraft, is fuel plus oxygen from the air create carbon dioxide and water along with massive quantities of heat. More oxygen into the engine means that for a given engine size, more fuel can be pumped in, so more energy can be created over each cycle. That's how those little 1.6-liter engines can replace the 2.4-liter engines of last year. But this extra power comes at a cost. First, parts must be designed to handle additional stress, which may lead to more kerblamos this season as engine manufacturers perfect their designs. The second problem is what's known as turbo lag. When the engine is running slowly, for example, when the car is moving around a turn, the rate of exhaust gas exiting the engine is low, so the turbo isn't being energized. When the driver presses the throttle pedal, the turbo can't do its job until the engine RPM increases and the exhaust gases start to push through the turbo. But if the turbo can't do its job, the engine can't speed up as quickly either. So it's sort of a chicken and egg concept, and it's enough to actually force drivers to change their driving style in order to avoid low RPMs. Fortunately, Formula One, being the technological juggernaut that it is, has found a solution. How can you force the turbo to spin immediately without depending on exhaust gas? Well, perhaps the giant battery on board could be used. That's right, the KERS system, now known as the ERS-K, has become much more capable and can speed up the turbo in the same way that it adds power to the wheels. This is one particular area that has promise for increasing efficiency in road cars. If you're not thrilled about the new engine sound, try thinking of the little turbo spinning at over 100,000 RPM, exchanging mechanical, thermal, and electrical energy in order to supply the engine with the precise amount of oxygen needed at all times to propel the car out of turns and down straights. I think that's pretty exciting. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Marcus Ericsson. You're listening to F1 Weekly.
Now we shall play our interview with Mr. Logan Sargeant, young American karting talent racing in Europe, doing very well. And this conversation was recorded when I was at Oschersleben in August. So my thanks to him, and please check out his website also.
Okay, folks, I'm here in Oschersleben, and Sergeant is on call. Mr. Logan Sergeant, welcome to F1 Weekly. How are you?
I'm doing good, thank you.
Okay, now tell us a little bit about yourself. You are from Florida. What part of Florida you are from, and what the heck are you doing here in Oschersleben?
I live in Boca Raton, Florida, but now I live in Switzerland for racing, and I'm here in Oschersleben for the German Championships, and at the moment I'm fourth in the European Championship, so that's next.
Living in Switzerland, life is tough for you.
Yeah, very tough because I don't have the ocean and the weather. So, yeah, I moved away from all my friends, so it's difficult.
And I guess no gators in Switzerland?
Nope.
Okay, let's start with your racing life. How did you pick up interest in motor racing? Was there interest in the family, or you just saw some racing on TV and said, this is what I want to do?
Well, when we first started, my dad did a little bit for fun, and then for my fifth birthday, he bought me a go-kart, and it just got bigger and bigger, and now we're doing worldwide championships.
How old are you now?
13.
Wow, teenager.
Yeah.
Great. Okay, now how many years of racing did you do in the U.S.?
I think about 6 years in the U.S.
And what were your big achievements there?
In the U.S., I became the national champion, and I also won the Super Nationals in Las Vegas.
What year was that?
Multiple.
Oh, you've won many times there?
Yes.
Vegas is a cool place, right?
Yes, it's very, very nice, yeah.
Now, you're from Florida, which is the home base of National Association of Stock Car Automobile Racing, also known as LANASCAR. How come you did not develop interest in Roundy Down?
Well, I've grown up watching Formula One for my entire life, but now my brother is doing NASCAR, so I want to go the different way and try Formula One.
Smart guy. Okay, now when you decided to come to Europe, how long you've been here, and how did you pick the team?
Well, it's been 2.5 years I've been in Europe. And we saw that RFM was a great team. They were winning a lot, and they were the top team. So that's how we chose to come here.
Okay, what's the big difference between a karting scene in the U.S. and Europe?
Well, the level is just completely different. It's way more difficult here. And there, I outgrew the level there, so in Europe it's very difficult.
It's difficult here because of the depth of the talent pool?
Yes, they're very good here, so I have to keep getting better.
So it's like a piranha pool. So in this piranha pool, are you at the top level, close to the surface? Are you bottom? Obviously, you're not sinking, which is good.
No. I'm actually, it's been really good this year. Like I said, at the moment, I'm fourth in the European Championship with one round to go. So we're going to try and win that.
That's right. And of course, this was part of German Championship. How did this weekend go for you?
Well, we started off really strong, and we qualified third, but we had a problem in the second heat, which set us to start sixth for the first final. In the first final, we had another problem with the engine, and only managed to finish 14. But now we came back to 6 or 7, I think it was, and we were pretty much the quickest the whole race. So.
Okay, where about do you live in Switzerland, and are you studying banking?
I live in Lugano, Lake Lugano.
Parla italiano, signor?
No, not so good.
Are you learning?
Sorry?
Are you learning Italian?
Yes, in school they teach me.
And I am sure your goal is Formula Uno.
Yes, of course.
Okay. How long do you want to stay in karting in Europe before you go into single-seaters?
Well, I start testing this year.
Oh, really?
Yes, so it should be interesting. And then I won't start racing until, I think, 15, when the age limit is.
So what will you be testing these days?
I'm going to start with the Carlin Academy car, and then I'll move up to F4.
F4 cool. And I met Trevor Carlin yesterday at the Nürburgring. He runs a pretty good operation. Okay, let's talk a little bit about Formula One. You said you've been following all your life, those 13 years of motor racing life. Who was your first Formula One hero?
Well, I really liked Michael Schumacher because he just showed true talent. And I also looking back, I really liked Art and Senna.
Absolutely. Now, Michael Schumacher's son, Mick Jr., is racing here. How good is he?
He's very, very good, and I think he has potential to be in Formula One if he drives well.
Wow. Okay, this season we're having a great battle between Mercedes teammates. Who would you like to see win the championship?
Definitely Lewis Hamilton.
A good man. Okay, tell me what you like most about motor racing. The speed, the sound, the technology, or the grid girls?
I love everything about it. Everything.
Okay. Thank you for your time. Please give a message to our listeners. We have listeners all over the world, and tell them about your website.
One Weekly is the best program.
Thank you so much.
Logan, thanks for joining F1Weekly.com. Nasser, we are entering the wonderful holiday season, which means only one thing here in the Palatial Studios, and that would be our beautiful calendar sales that support this podcast and keeps the floors clean, the marble sanitized and deodorized in the Palatial Studios. So please, Nasser, let's get a little promotion out there the calendar.
My many thanks to Toby for helping me out. He updates the Saison 73 website every year, so many thanks to him for that. The calendar theme this year is for 2015 is Samba and Tango, the Latin beat of Formula Uno, and we have fantastic photographs, Lotus 72 gold leaf colors from Montjuic Park with Emerson Fittipaldi on the cover. Back cover, we have Ayrton Senna da Silva in his McLaren Honda. And then we have Pedro Rodriguez, Ricardo Rodriguez, Pastor Maldonado, Monty.
Hi, I'm Juan Pablo Montoya, and you're listening to F1 Weekly.
Then we have, all the great legends that came from South America, Fangio, Jose Froline Gonzalez, Carlos Reutemann, Carlos Pache. So it's, again, a lot of time was spent in gathering information, selecting the beautiful photographs. So we look forward to support from F1 Weekly Familia members.
And if people want them right now, just email us.
Yes.
And we'll take care of business.
Very true.
Absolutely. And, of course, for a minute there, I thought you might have gotten that picture of me in my flamenco outfit playing the castanets.
I will have to start a new calendar now.
Yeah, that would sell, Nasser. That's the big bucks. Exactly. So, yes, please order calendars now. Email Nasser or myself, whatever, info@f1weekly.com. And Nass ships in one business day.
Yeah, well, I'm in ABQ now, so it might take a few additional days, but they will get there within 2 weeks for sure.
Outstanding.
We ship them out by priority mail within the U.S. and first-class airmail overseas.
And what is the price of this beautiful calendar, Nasser?
It was last year, senor.
Wow, we didn't raise prices?
Not yet.
That shows that we are not only wonderful, but humanitarians as well.
Absolutely. We try to be, despite all our animal instincts.
Exactly. So, yes, looking forward to that. Yes, please order your calendars. Don't forget, Mom wants two of them. Nass?
Yes, sir.
I'll see you next week at the Palacio Studios for the Brazilian podcast. We'll be giving Brazilian wax treatments for free for whoever shows up.
Brazilian carnauba wax.
Exactly. Wow. So there you have it, Nass. Thanks for listening, everyone. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Sometimes I almost wish Italian Swiss Colony hadn't brought out these two new California table wines. They're tearing my kitchen apart.
I say Italian Swiss Colony Chianti is lighter.
And I say the Rheinskeller is lighter.
Ah, but new Italian Swiss Colony Chianti is so light, you can enjoy it glass after glass, even with your heavy Wiener Schnitzel.
But new Rheinskeller is so wunderbar light, it makes taste good even your chicken cacciatore.
I still say Italian Swiss Colony Chianti is lighter.
And I say Rheinskeller.
Chianti.
Rheinskeller.
What I say is, let the customer decide which new Italian Swiss Colony wine you prefer. Red Chianti, light in the Italian style, or white Rheinskeller, light in the German style. After all, you're the one who's always right.
Crimps de Malurey. Crimps de Malurey. May continue.
Le Crimps de Malurey. Le Crimps de Malurey. Call from Dr. Bombay.